Gods have no one to pray to. The great god Om scurried towards the nearest statue, neck stretched, inefficient legs pumping. The statue happened to be himself as a bull, trampling an infidel, although this was no great comfort. It was only a matter of time before the eagle stopped circling and swooped. Om had been a tortoise for only 3 years, but with the shape he had inherited a grab bag of instincts, and a lot of them centred around a total terror of the one wild creature that had found out how to eat tortoise. Gods have no one to pray to. Om really wished that this was not the case. But everyone needs someone.
Brother.
Brother was a little uncertain about his immediate future. Deacon Vorbis had clearly cut him loose from his chores as a novice, but he had nothing to do for the rest of the afternoon. He gravitated towards the garden. There were beans to tie up, and he welcomed the fact. You knew where you were with beans. They didn't tell you to do impossible things like forget. Besides, if he was going to be away for a while, he ought to mulch the melons and explain things to Lutse. Lutse came with the gardens. Every organization has someone like him. They might be pushing a broom in obscure corridors or wandering among the shelves in the back of the stores, where they are the only person who knows where anything is, or have some ambiguous but essential relationship with the boiler room. Everyone knows who they are, and no one remembers a time when they weren't there, or knows where they go when they're not, well, where they usually are. Just occasionally, people who are slightly more observant than most other people, which is not on the face of it very difficult, stop and wonder about them for a while, and then get on with something else. Strangely enough, given his gentle ambling from garden to garden around the citadel, Lutse never showed much interest in the plants themselves. He dealt in soil, manure, muck, compost, loam and dust, and the means of moving it about. Generally, he was pushing a broom or turning over a heap. Once anyone put seeds in anything, he lost interest. He was raking the paths when Brother entered. He was good at raking paths. He left scallop patterns and gentle, soothing curves. Brother always felt apologetic about walking on them. He hardly ever spoke to Lutse, because it didn't matter much what anyone ever said to Lutse. The old man just nodded and smiled his single-toothed smile in any case. "I'm going away for a little while," said Brother, loudly and distinctly. "I expect someone else will be sent to look after the gardens, but there are some things that need doing." Nod. Smile. The old man followed him patiently along the rows, while Brother spoke beans and herbs. "Understand?" said Brother, after 10 minutes of this. Nod. Smile. Nod, smile, beckon. What? Nod, smile, beckon. Nod, smile, beckon, smile. Lutse walked his little crab monkey walk to the little area at the far end of the walled garden which contained his heaps, the flower pot stacks, and all the other cosmetics of the garden beautiful. The old man slept there, Brother suspected. Nod, smile, beckon. There was a small trestle table in the sun by a stack of bean canes. A straw mat had been spread on it, and on the mat were half a dozen pointy-shaped rocks, none of them bigger than a foot high. A careful arrangement of sticks had been constructed around them. Bits of thin wood shadowed some parts of the rocks. Small metal mirrors directed sunlight towards other areas. Paper cones at odd angles appeared to be funneling the breeze to very precise points. Brother had never heard about the art of bonsai and how it was applied to mountains. "They're very nice," he said uncertainly. Nod, smile, pick up a small rock, smile, urge, urge. "Oh, I really couldn't take urge, urge, grin, nod." Brother took the tiny mountain. It had a strange, unreal heaviness. To his hand it felt like a pound or so, but in his head it weighed thousands of very, very small tons.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Nod, smile, push away politely.
It's very, mountainous.
Nod, grin.
That can't really be snow on the top, can?
Brother!
His head jerked up, but the voice had come from inside.
Oh, no, he thought wretchedly.
He pushed the little mountain back into Lutse's hands.
But, you keep it for me, yes?
Brother!
All that was a dream, wasn't it, before I was important and talked to by deacons?
No, it wasn't. Help me.
The petitioners scattered as the eagle made a pass over the place of lamentation. It wheeled only a few feet above the ground and perched on the statue of Great Om, trampling the infidel. It was a magnificent bird, golden brown and yellow-eyed, and it surveyed the crowds with blank disdain.
"It's a sign," said an old man with a wooden leg. "Yes, yes, a sign," said a young woman next to him. "A sign."
They gathered round the statue.
"It's a bugger,"
said a small and totally unheard voice from somewhere around their feet.
"But what's it a sign of?"
said an elderly man who had been camping out in the square for 3 days.
"What do you mean, of? It's a sign," said the wooden-legged man. "It don't have to be a sign of anything. That's a suspicious kind of question to ask. What's it a sign of?" "There's got to be a sign of something," said the elderly man. "That's a referential wussen in the name. A gerund."
"Yeah,
could be a gerund."
A skinny figure appeared at the edge of the group, moving surreptitiously yet with surprising speed. It was wearing the jeliba of the desert tribes, but around its neck was a tray on a strap. There was an ominous suggestion of sticky sweet things covered in dust.
"It could be a messenger from the great god himself," said the woman.
"It's a bloody eagle, is what it is,"
said a resigned voice from somewhere among the ornamental bronze homicide at the base of the statue.
"Dates, figs, sherbets, holy relics, nice fresh indulgences, lizards on a stick,"
said the man with the tray, hopefully.
"I thought when he appeared in the world it was as a swan or a bull," said the wooden-legged man.
"Eh," said the unregarded voice of the tortoise.
"Always wondered about that,"
said a young novice at the back of the crowd.
"You know, well, swans are a bit lacking in machismo, yes?" "May you be stoned to death for blasphemy,"
said the woman hotly.
"The great God hears every irreverent word you utter."
"Eh,"
from under the statue. And the man with the tray oiled forward a little further, saying,
"Kalachian delight, honeyed wasps, get them while they're cold."
"It's a point, though,"
said the elderly man in a kind of boring, unstoppable voice.
"I mean, there's something very godly about an eagle.
King of birds, am I right?" "It's only a better-looking turkey,"
said the voice from under the statue.
"Brain the size of a walnut."
"Very noble bird, the eagle. Intelligent, too,"
said the elderly man.
"Interesting fact, eagles are the only birds to work out how to eat tortoises, you know. They pick 'em up, flying up very high, and drop them onto the rocks. Smashes 'em right open. Amazing."
"One day," said a dull voice from down below, "I'm going to be back on form again, and you're going to be very sorry you said that. For a very long time. I might even go so far as to make even more time just for you to be sorry in. Or, no, I'll make you a tortoise. See how you like it, eh? That rushing wind around your shell, the ground getting bigger the whole time. That'd be an interesting fact."
"That sounds dreadful," said the woman, looking up at the eagle's glare. "I wonder what passes through the poor little creature's head when he's dropped."
"His shell, madam,"
said the great god Om, trying to squeeze himself even further under the bronze overhang. The man with the tray was looking dejected.
"Tell you what,"
he said,
"two bags of sugared dates for the price of one. How about it? And that's cutting my own hand off."
The woman glanced at the tray.
"Here, there's flies all over everything," she said.
"Currants, madam."
"Why'd they just fly away, then?"
the woman demanded. The man looked down, then he looked back up into her face.
"A miracle," he said, waving his hands dramatically. "The time of miracles is at hand."
The eagle shifted uneasily. It recognised humans only as pieces of mobile landscape, which in the lambing season in the high hills might be associated with thrown stones when it stooped upon the newborn lamb, but which otherwise were as unimportant in the scheme of things as bushes and rocks. But it had never been so close to so many of them. Its mad eyes swivelled backwards and forwards uncertainly. At that moment, trumpets rang out across the place. The eagle looked around wildly, its tiny predatory mind trying to deal with this sudden overload. It leapt into the air. The worshippers fought to get out of its way as it dipped across the flagstones and then rose majestically towards the turrets of the great temple and the hot sky. Below it, the doors of the great temple, each one made of 40 tons of gilded bronze, opened by the breath, it was said, of the great god himself, swung open ponderously, and this was the holy part, silently. Brother's enormous sandals flapped and flapped on the flagstones. Brother always put a lot of effort into running. He ran from the knees, lower legs thrashing like paddle wheels. This was too much. There was a tortoise who said he was the god, and this couldn't be true except that it must be true because of what it knew. And he'd been tried by the Quisition, or something like that. Anyway, it hadn't been as painful as he'd been led to expect.
Brother!
The square, normally alive with the susurration of 1,000 prayers, had gone quiet. The pilgrims had all turned to face the temple. His mind boiling with the events of the day, Brother shouldered his way through the suddenly silent crowd.
Brother!
People have reality dampers. It is a popular fact that 9/10 of the brain is not used, and like most popular facts, it is wrong. Not even the most stupid creator would go to the trouble of making the human head carry around several pounds of unnecessary grey goo if its only real purpose was, for example, to serve as a delicacy for certain remote tribesmen in unexplored valleys. It is used, and one of its functions is to make the miraculous seem ordinary and turn the unusual into the usual. Because if this was not the case, then human beings, faced with the daily wondrousness of everything, would go around wearing big, stupid grins, similar to those worn by certain remote tribesmen who occasionally get raided by the authorities and have the contents of their plastic greenhouses very seriously inspected. They'd say, "Wow," a lot, and no one would do much work. Gods don't like people not doing much work. People who aren't busy all the time might start to think. Part of the brain exists to stop this happening. It is very efficient. It can make people experience boredom in the middle of marvels. And Brothers was working feverishly. So he didn't immediately notice that he'd pushed through the last row of people and had trotted out into the middle of a wide pathway until he turned and saw the procession approaching. The Cenobiarch was returning to his apartments after conducting, or at least nodding vaguely while his chaplain conducted on his behalf, the evening service. Brother spun round, looking for a way to escape. Then there was a cough beside him, and he stared up into the furious faces of a couple of lesser EMs, and between them the bemused and geriatrically good-natured expression of the Cenobiarch himself. The old man raised his hand automatically to bless Brother with the holy horns, and then two members of the Divine Legion picked up the novice by the elbows on the second attempt and marched him swiftly out of the procession's path and hurled him into the crowd.
Brother!
Brother bounded across the plaza to the statue and leaned against it, panting.
"I'm going to go to hell," he muttered, "for all eternity."
"Who cares? Now, get me away from here."
No one was paying him any attention now. They were all watching the procession. Even watching the procession was a holy act. Brother knelt down and peered into the scrollwork around the base of the statue. One beady eye glared back at him.
"How did you get under there?"
"It was touch and go," said the tortoise. "I tell you, when I'm back on form, there's going to be a considerable redesigning of eagles."
"What's the eagle trying to do to you?" said Brother.
"It wants to carry me off to its nest and give me dinner," snarled the tortoise. "What do you think it wanted to do?"
There was a short pause in which it contemplated the futility of sarcasm in the presence of Brother. It was like throwing meringues at a castle.
"It wants to eat me," it said patiently.
"But you're a tortoise."
"I am your god."
"But currently in the shape of a tortoise, with a shell on, is what I mean.
That doesn't worry eagles, said the tortoise darkly. They pick you up, carry you a few hundred feet, and then drop you.
Ooh.
No, more like crack splat. How did you think I got in here?
You were dropped, but I...
Landed on a pile of dirt in your garden. That's eagles for you. Whole place built of rock and paved with rock on a big rock, and they miss.
That was lucky. Million to one chance, said Brother.
I never had this trouble when I was a bull. The number of eagles who can pick up a bull, you can count them on the fingers of one head. Anyway, said the tortoise, there's worse here than eagles. There's good eating on one of them, you know, said a voice behind Brother.
He stood up guiltily, the tortoise in his hand.
Oh, hello, Mr. Dublar, he said.
Everyone in the city knew cut-me-own-hand-off Dublar, purveyor of suspiciously new holy relics, suspiciously old rancid sweetmeats on a stick, gritty figs, and long past the sell-by dates. He was a sort of natural force, like the wind. No one knew where he came from or where he went at night, but he was there every dawn selling sticky things to the pilgrims. And in this, the priests reckoned he was onto a good thing, because most of the pilgrims were coming for the first time and therefore lacked the essential thing you needed in dealing with Dublar, which was the experience of having dealt with him before. The sight of someone in the place trying to unstick their jaws with dignity was a familiar one. Many a devout pilgrim, after 1,000 miles of perilous journey, was forced to make his petition in sign language.
"Fancy some sherbet for afters," said Dublar, hopefully. "Only one cent a glass, and that's cutting me own hand off." "Who is this fool?" said Om.
"I'm not going to eat it," said Brother, hurriedly.
"Going to teach it to do tricks, then," said Dublar, cheerfully. "Look through hoops, that kind of thing." "Get rid of him," said Om. "Smite him on the head, why don't you, and push the body behind the statue."
"Shut up," said Brother, beginning to experience once again the problems that occur when you're talking to someone no one else can hear.
"No need to be like that about it," said Dublar.
"I wasn't talking to you," said Brother.
"Talking to the tortoise, were you?" said Dublar.
Brother looked guilty.
"My old mum used to talk to a gerbil," Dublar went on. "Pets are always a great help in times of stress, and in times of starvation too, of course." "This man..." "He's not honest," said Om. "I can read his mind."
"Can you?"
"Can I what?" said Dublar.
He gave Brother a lopsided look.
"Anyway, it'll be company on your journey."
"What journey?"
"To Ephib, the secret mission to talk to the infidel."
Brother knew he shouldn't be surprised. News went around the enclosed world of the citadel like a bushfire after a drought.
"Oh," he said, "that journey."
"They say Friot's going," said Dublar, "and that other one, the Aminance Grise."
"Deacon Vorbis is a very nice person," said Brother. "He has been very kind to me. He gave me a drink."
"What of?" "Never mind," said Dublar. "Of course I wouldn't say a word against him myself," he added quickly. "Why are you talking to this stupid person?"
Om demanded.
"He's a... friend of mine," said Brother.
"I wish he was a friend of mine," said Dublar. "Friends like that, you never have enemies. Can I press you to a candid sultana on a stick?"
There were 23 other novices in Brother's dormitory, on the principle that sleeping alone promoted sin. This always puzzled the novices themselves, since a moment's reflection would suggest that there were whole ranges of sins only available in company. But that was because a moment's reflection was the biggest sin of all. People allowed to be by themselves overmuch might indulge in solitary cogitation. It was well known that this stunted your growth. For one thing, it could lead to your feet being chopped off. So Brother had to retire to the garden, with his god screaming at him from the pocket of his robe, where it was being jostled by a ball of garden twine, a pair of shears, and some loose seeds. Finally he was fished out.
"Luke, I didn't have a chance to tell you," said Brother. "I've been chosen to go on a very important mission. I'm going to Ephib on a mission to the infidels. Deacon Vorbis picked me. He's my friend."
Who's he?
He's the chief exquisitor. He makes sure you're worshipped properly.
Om picked up the hesitation in Brother's voice and remembered the grating and the sheer busyness below.
He tortures people, he said coldly.
Oh, no, the Inquisitors do that. They work very long hours for not much money, too, Brother Nomrod says. No, the Exquisitors just, arrange matters. Every Inquisitor wants to become an Exquisitor one day, Brother Nomrod says. That's why they put up with being on duty at all hours. They go for days without sleep sometimes.
Torturing people, mused the god.
No, a mind like that one in the garden wouldn't pick up a knife. Other people would do that. Vorbis would enjoy other methods. Letting out the badness and the heresy in people, said Brother.
But people perhaps don't survive the process?
Well, that doesn't matter, said Brother, earnestly. What happens to us in this life is not really real. There may be a little pain, but that doesn't matter. Not if it ensures less time in the hells after death.
But what if the Exquisitors are wrong? Said the tortoise.
Oh, they can't be wrong, said Brother. They are guided by the hand of... by your hand. Your front leg, I mean. Your claw, he mumbled.
The tortoise blinked its one eye. It remembered the heat of the sun, the helplessness, and a face watching it not with any cruelty, but worse, with interest. Someone watching something die just to see how long it took. He'd remember that face anywhere, and the mind behind it, that steel ball of a mind.
But suppose something went wrong, it insisted.
Oh, I'm not any good at theology, said Brother, but the testament of Ossory is very clear on the matter. They must have done something, otherwise you, in your wisdom, would not direct the quisition to them.
Would I?
Said Om, still thinking of that face.
It's their fault they get tortured. Did I really say that?
We are judged in life as we are in death. Ossory the third, chapter 6, verse 56.
My grandmother said that when people die, they come before you, they have to cross a terrible desert, and you weigh their heart in some scales, said Brother. And if it weighs less than a feather, they are spared the hells.
Goodness me, said the tortoise.
And it added, has it occurred to you, lad, that I might not be able to do that and be down here walking around with a shell on?
You could do anything you wanted to, said Brother.
Om looked up at Brother.
He really believes, he thought. He doesn't know how to lie.
The strength of Brother's belief burned in him like a flame. And then the truth hit Om like the ground hits tortoises after an attack of eagles.
You've got to take me to this Ephebe place, he said urgently.
I'll do whatever you want, said Brother. Are you going to scourge it with hoof and flame?
Could be, said Om. But you've got to take me.
He was trying to keep his innermost thoughts calm in case Brother heard,
Don't leave me behind.
But you could get there much quicker if I left you, said Brother.
They are very wicked in Ephebe. The sooner it is cleansed, the better. You could stop being a tortoise and fly there like a burning wind and scourge the city.
A burning wind, thought Om, and the tortoise thought of the silent wastes of the deep desert and the chittering and sighing of the gods who had faded away to mere djinns and voices on the air. Gods with no more believers, not even one. One was just enough. Gods who had been left behind. And the thing about Brother's flame of belief was this. In all the citadel, in all the day, it was the only one the god had found. Fryett was trying to pray. He hadn't done so for a long time. Oh, of course, there had been the 8 compulsory prayers every day, but in the pit of the wretched night he knew them for what they were, a habit, a time for thought, perhaps, and method of measuring time. He wondered if he'd ever prayed, if he'd ever opened heart and mind to something out there, or up there. He must have done, mustn't he? Perhaps when he was young. He couldn't even remember that. Blood had washed away the memories. It was his fault. It had to be his fault. He'd been to Ephib before, and had rather liked the white marble city on its rock overlooking the blue circle sea. And he'd visited Djelibebi, those madmen in their little river valley who believed in gods with funny heads and put their dead in pyramids. He'd even been to far Ankh Morpork, across the water, where they'd worship any god at all so long as he or she had money. Yes, Ankh Morpork, where there were streets and streets of gods, squeezed together like a deck of cards, and none of them wanted to set fire to anyone else, or at least any more than was normally the case in Ankh Morpork. They just wanted to be left in peace so that everyone went to heaven or hell in their own way. And he'd drunk too much tonight, from a secret cache of wine, whose discovery would deliver him into the machinery of the Inquisitors within 10 minutes. Yes, you could say this for old Vorbis. Once upon a time the Quisition had been bribeable, but not any more. The chief exquisitor had gone back to fundamentals. Now there was a democracy of sharp knives. Better than that, in fact. The search for heresy was pursued even more vigorously among the higher levels in the church. Vorbis had made it clear, the higher up the tree, the blunter the saw. Give me that old-time religion. He squeezed his eyes shut again, and all he could see was the horns of the temple, or fragmented suggestions of the carnage to come, or the face of Vorbis. He'd liked that white city. Even the slaves had been content. There were rules about slaves. There were things you couldn't do to slaves. Slaves had value. He'd learned about the turtle there. It had all made sense. He'd thought, it sounds right. It makes sense. But sense or not, that thought was sending him to hell. Vorbis knew about him. He must do. There were spies everywhere. Sasho had been useful, but how much had Vorbis got out of him? Had he said what he knew? Of course he'd say what he knew. Something went snap inside Fryett. He glanced at his sword hanging on the wall. And why not? After all, he was going to spend all eternity in 1,000 hells. The knowledge was freedom, of a sort. When the least they could do to you was everything, then the most they could do to you suddenly held no terror. If he was going to be boiled for a lamb, then he might as well be roasted for a sheep. He staggered to his feet and after a couple of tries got the sword belt off the wall. Vorbis's quarters weren't far away. If he could manage the steps, one stroke, that's all it would take. He could cut Vorbis in half without trying, and maybe nothing would happen afterwards. There were others who felt like him, somewhere. Or anyway, he could get down to the stables, be well away by dawn, get to Ephib, maybe, across the desert. He reached the door and fumbled for the handle. It turned of its own accord. Fryett staggered back as the doors swung inwards. Vorbis was standing there, in the flickering light of the oil lamp. His face registered polite concern.
"Excuse the lateness of the hour, my lord," he said, "but I thought we should talk." "About tomorrow."
The sword clattered out of Fryett's hands. Vorbis leaned forward.
"Is there something wrong, brother?" he said.
He smiled and stepped into the room. 2 hooded inquisitors slipped in behind him.
"Brother," Vorbis said again, and shut the door. "How is it in there?"
said Brother.
"I'm going to rattle around like a pea in a pot," grumbled the tortoise.
"I could put some more straw in. And look, I've got these."
A pile of green stuff dropped on Om's head.
"From the kitchen," said Brother. "Peelings and cabbage. I stole them," he added. "But then I thought it can't be stealing if I'm doing it for you."
The fetid smell of the half-rotten leaves suggested strongly that Brother had committed his crime when the greens were halfway to the midden, but Om didn't say so, not now.
"Right," he mumbled.
There must be others, he told himself. Sure. Out in the country. This place is too sophisticated. But there had been all those pilgrims in front of the temple. They weren't just country people. They were the devoutest ones. Whole villages clubbed together to send one person carrying the petitions of many. But there hadn't been the flame. There had been fear and dread and yearning and hope. And all those emotions had their flavour, but there hadn't been the flame. The eagle had dropped him near Brother. He'd woken up. He could dimly remember all that time as a tortoise, and now he remembered being a god. How far away from Brother would he still remember? 1 mile? 10 miles? How would it be, feeling the knowledge drain away, dwindling back to nothing but a lowly reptile?
Maybe there would be a part of him that would always remember, helplessly. He shuddered. Currently, Om was in a wickerwork box slung from Brother's shoulder. It wouldn't have been comfortable at the best of times, but now it shook occasionally as Brother stamped his feet in the pre-dawn chill. After a while, some of the Citadel grooms arrived with horses. Brother was the subject of a few odd looks. He smiled at everyone. It seemed the best way. He began to feel hungry, but didn't dare leave his post. He'd been told to be here. But after a while, sounds from around the corner made him sidle a few yards to see what was going on. The courtyard here was U-shaped, around a wing of the Citadel buildings, and around the corner it looked as though another party was preparing to set out. Brother knew about camels. There had been a couple in his grandmother's village. There seemed to be hundreds of them here, though, complaining like badly oiled pumps and smelling like 1,000 damp carpets. Men in Djeliba moved among them and occasionally hit them with sticks, which is the approved method of dealing with camels. Brother wandered over to the nearest creature. A man was strapping water bottles round its hump.
"Good morning, brother," said Brother.
"Bagger off," said the man without looking round.
"The prophet Abbas tells us, chapter 25, verse 6, woe unto he who defiles his mouth with curses, for his words will be as dust," said Brother.
"Does he? Well, he can bagger off too," said the man conversationally.
Brother hesitated. Technically, of course, the man had bought himself vacant possession of 1,000 hells and a month or two of the attentions of the Quisition. But now Brother could see that he was a member of the Divine Legion. A sword was half hidden under the desert robes. And you had to make special allowances for legionaries, just as you did for inquisitors. Their often intimate contact with the ungodly affected their minds and put their souls in mortal peril. He decided to be magnanimous.
"And where are you going to with all these camels on this fine morning, brother?"
The soldier tightened a strap.
"Probably to hell," he said, grinning nastily. "Just behind you."
"Really? According to the word of the prophet Ish-Kaibel, a man needs no camel to ride to hell, yea, nor horse nor mule. A man may ride into hell on his tongue," said Brother, letting just a tremor of disapproval enter his voice.
"Does some old prophet say anything about nosy bastards being given a thump alongside the ear?" said the soldier.
"Woe unto him who raises his hand unto his brother, dealing with him as unto an infidel," said Brother. "That's Ossory, Precepts 11, verse 16.
"Sod off and forget you ever saw us. Otherwise you're going to be in real trouble, my friend. Sergeant Akhtar, chapter 1, verse 1, said the soldier.
Brother's brow wrinkled. He couldn't remember that one.
"Walk away," said the voice of the god in his head. "You don't need trouble."
"I hope your journey is a pleasant one," said Brother politely, "whatever the destination."
He backed away and headed towards the gate.
"A man who will have to spend some time in the hells of correction, if I am any judge," he said.
The god said nothing. The Ephebian travelling group was beginning to assemble now. Brother stood to attention and tried to keep out of everyone's way. He saw a dozen mounted soldiers, but unlike the camel riders, they were in the brightly polished fish mail and black and yellow cloaks that the legionaries usually only wore on special occasions. Brother thought they looked very impressive. Eventually, one of the stable servants came up to him.
"What are you doing here, novice?"
he demanded.
"I am going to Ephebe," said Brother.
The man glared at him and then grinned.
"You? You're not even ordained. You're going to Ephebe?"
"Yes."
"What makes you think that?" "Because I told him so," said the voice of Vorbis behind the man, "and here he is, most obedient to my wishes."
Brother had a good view of the man's face. The change in his expression was like watching a grease slick cross a pond. Then the stableman turned as though his feet were nailed to a turntable.
"My lord Vorbis," he oiled. "And now he will require a steed," said Vorbis.
The stableman's face was yellow with dread.
"My pleasure, the very best stable. My friend Brother is a humble man before Om," said Vorbis. "He will ask for no more than a mule, I have no doubt, Brother."
"Aye,
"'I do not know how to ride, my lord,' said Brother.
"'Any man can get on a mule,' said Vorbis, "'often many times in a short distance. "'And now it would appear we are all here?'
"'He raised an eyebrow at the sergeant of the guard, who saluted.
"'We are awaiting General Froyet, lord,' he said.
"'Ah, Sergeant Simony, isn't it?'
"'Vorbis had a terrible memory for names. "'He knew every one. "'The sergeant paled a little and then saluted crisply.
"'Yes, sir!'
"'We will proceed without General Fryett,' said Vorbis.
"'The B of the word but framed itself on the sergeant's lips and faded there.
"'General Fryett has other business,' said Vorbis, "'most pressing and urgent business, which only he can attend to.'